painting them stark naked. Nothing can defend or excuse this. It is shockingly absurd, even an Indian being the judge. I allow a man who paints thus may have a good hand, but certainly no brains. Wesley on a Sentimental Journey. Tuesday the 11th, I casually took a volume of what is called A Sentimental Journey Through France and Italy. Sentimental? What is that? It is not English. You might as well say continental. It is not sense. It conveys no determinate idea. Yet one fool makes many. And this nonsensical word, who would believe it, has become a fashionable one. However, the book agrees full well with the title, for one is as queer as the other. For oddity, uncouthness, and unlikeness to all the world beside, I suppose the writer is without a rival. Wednesday the 12th. In returning, I read a very different book, published by an honest Quaker, on that execrable sum of all villainies, commonly called the slave trade. I read of nothing like it in the heathen world, whether ancient or modern, and it infinitely exceeds in every instance of barbarity whatever Christian slaves suffer in Mohammedan countries. Friday the 14th, I began to execute a design which had long been in my thoughts, to print as accurate an edition of my works as a bookseller would do. Surely I ought to be as exact for God's sake as he would be for money. Monday the 17th, one gave me a very remarkable account. A gay young woman lately came up to London. Curiosity led her to hear a sermon which cut her to the heart. One standing by observed how she was affected and took occasion to talk with her. She lamented that she should hear no more such sermons, as she was to go into the country the next day. But she begged her new acquaintance to write to her there, which she promised to do. In the country, her conviction so increased that she resolved to put an end to her own life. With this design, she was going upstairs when her father called her and gave her a letter from London. It was from her new acquaintance, who told her, "Christ is just ready to receive you. Now is the day of salvation." She cried out, it is, Christ is mine," and was filled with joy unspeakable. She begged her father to give her pen, ink, and paper, that she might answer her friend immediately. She told her what God had done for her soul and added, "We have no time to lose. The Lord is at hand. Now, even now, we are stepping into eternity." She directed her letter, dropped down, and died. Wesley in the boarding school. Friday the 21st, I met several of my friends who had begun a subscription to prevent my riding on horseback, which I cannot do quite so well since a hurt which I got some months ago. If they continue it, well, if not, I shall have strength according to my need. Monday, April 6th, Manchester. In the afternoon, I drank tea at M.O., but how was I shocked? The children that used to cling about me and drink in every word had been at a boarding school. There they had unlearned all religion and even seriousness, and had learned pride, vanity, affectation, and whatever could guard them against the knowledge and love of God. Methodist parents who would send your girls headlong to hell, send them to a fashionable boarding school. Tuesday the 14th, I set out for Carlisle. A great part of the road was miserably bad. However, we reached it in the afternoon and found a small company of plain, loving people. The place where they had appointed me to preach was out of the gate, yet it was tolerably filled with attentive hearers. Afterward, inquiring for the Glasgow road, I found it was not much round to go by Edinburgh, so I chose that road and went 5 miles forward this evening to one of our friends' houses. Here we had a hearty welcome under a lowly roof with sweet and quiet rest. Wednesday the 15th. Though it was a lone house, we had a large congregation at 5 in the morning. Afterward, we rode for upwards of 20 miles through a most delightful country, the fruitful mountains rising on either hand, the clear stream running beneath. In the afternoon, we had a furious storm of rain and snow. However, we reached Selkirk safe. Here I observed a little piece of stateliness which was quite new to me. The maid came in and said, "Sir, the lord of the stable waits to know if he should feed your horses." We called him ostler in England. After supper, all the family seemed glad to join with us in prayer. Thursday the 16th, we went on through the mountains, covered with snow, to Edinburgh. Saturday the 18th, I set out for Glasgow. One would rather have imagined it was the middle of January than the middle of April. The snow covered the mountains on either hand, and the frost was exceedingly sharp. So I preached within both this evening and on Sunday morning. But in the evening, the multitude constrained me to stand in the street. My text was, "What God has cleansed, that call not thou common." Acts 10:15. Hence I took occasion to fall upon their miserable bigotry for opinions and modes of worship. Many seem to be not a little convinced, but how long will the impression continue? Wesley at Greenock and Glasgow. Monday the 20th. I went on to Greenock, a seaport town 20 miles west of Glasgow. It is built very much like Plymouth Dock and has a safe and spacious harbor. The trade and inhabitants, and consequently the houses, are increasing swiftly, and so is cursing, swearing, drunkenness, Sabbath breaking, and all manner of wickedness. Our room is about thrice as large as that at Glasgow, but it would not near contain the congregation. I spoke exceedingly plain and not without hope that we may see some fruit, even among this hard-hearted generation. Tuesday the 21st. The house was very full in the morning, and they showed an excellent spirit. After I had spoken a few words on the head, everyone stood up at the singing. In the afternoon, I preached at Port Glasgow, a large town 2 miles east of Greenock. Many gay people were there, careless enough, but the greater part seemed to hear with understanding. In the evening, I preached at Greenock. God gave them a loud call, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear. Wednesday the 22nd, about 8, I preached once more in the Mason's Lodge at Port Glasgow. The house was crowded greatly, and I suppose all the gentry of the town were part of the congregation. Resolving not to shoot over their heads, as I had done the day before, I spoke strongly of death and judgment, heaven and hell. This they seemed to comprehend, and there was no more laughing among them or talking with each other, but all were quietly and deeply attentive. In the evening when I began at Glasgow, the congregation being but small, I chose a subject fit for experienced Christians. But soon after, a heap of fine gay people came in. Yet I could not decently break off what I was about, though they gaped and stared abundantly. I could only give a short exhortation in the close, more suited to their capacity. Wesley receives the freedom of Perth. Tuesday the 28th, Dunkeld. We walked through the Duke of Athol's gardens, in which was one thing I never saw before, a summer house in the middle of a greenhouse, by means of which one might in the depth of winter enjoy the warmth of May and sit surrounded with greens and flowers on every side. In the evening I preached once more at Perth to a large and serious congregation. Afterward they did me an honor I never thought of, presented me with the freedom of the city. In my way to Perth, I read over the first volume of Dr. Robertson's History of Charles V. I know not when I have been so disappointed. It might as well be called the History of Alexander the Great. Here is a quarto volume of 8 or 10 shillings price, containing dry, verbose dissertations on feudal government, the substance of all which might be comprised in half a sheet of paper. But Charles V? Where is Charles V? Leave off thy reflections and give us thy tale. Wednesday the 29th, I went on to Brecon and preached in the town hall to a congregation of all sorts, seceders, Glassites, non-jurors, and whatnot. Oh, what excuse have ministers in Scotland for not declaring the whole counsel of God, where the bulk of the people not only endure but love plain dealing. Friday and Saturday I rested at Aberdeen. Sunday, May 3rd, I went in the morning to the English church. Here, likewise, I could not but admire the exemplary decency of the congregation. This was the more remarkable because so miserable a reader I never heard before. Listening with all attention, I understood but one single word, Balak, in the first lesson, and one more, Begat, was all I could possibly distinguish in the second. Is there no man of spirit belonging to this congregation? Why is such a burlesque upon public worship suffered? Would it not be far better to pay this gentleman for doing nothing than for doing mischief and for bringing a scandal upon religion? About three I preached at the college kirk in the old town to a large congregation, rich and poor, at six in our own house on the narrow way. I spoke exceedingly plainly both this evening and the next, yet none were offended. What encouragement has every preacher in this country, by manifestation of the truth, to commend himself to every man's conscience in the sight of God? Tuesday the 5th. In the evening I preached in the new house at Arbroath, properly Eberbrothy. In this town there is a change indeed. It was wicked to a proverb, remarkable for Sabbath breaking, cursing, swearing, drunkenness, and a general contempt of religion. But is not so now. Open wickedness disappears, no oaths are heard, no drunkenness seen in the streets. And many have not only ceased from evil and learned to do well, but are witnesses of the inward kingdom of God. Righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Ghost. Wednesday the 6th. The magistrates here also did me the honor of presenting me with the freedom of their corporation. I value it as a token of their respect, though I shall hardly make any further use of it. Wesley visits the Bass Rock. Wednesday the 20th. In the evening I preached at Dunbar. Thursday the 21st I went to the Bass, 7 miles from it, which, in the horrid reign of Charles II, was the prison of those venerable men who suffered the loss of all things for a good conscience. It is a high rock surrounded by the sea, 2 or 3 miles in circumference, and about 2 miles from the shore. The strong east wind made the water so rough that the boat could hardly live, and when we came to the only landing place, the other sides being quite perpendicular, it was with much difficulty that we got up, climbing on our hands and knees. The castle, as one may judge by what remains, was utterly inaccessible. The walls of the chapel and of the governor's house are tolerably entire. The garden walls are still seen near the top of the rock, with the well in the midst of it, and round the walls there are spots of grass that feed 18 or 20 sheep. But the proper natives of the island are Solan's geese, a bird about the size of a Muscovy duck, which breed by thousands, from generation to generation, on the sides of the rock. It is perpendicular to these that they lay but one egg, which they do not sit upon at all, but keep it under 1 foot, as we saw with our eyes, till it is hatched. How many prayers did the holy men confined here offer up in that evil day? And how many thanksgivings should we return for all the liberty, civil and religious, which we enjoy? At our return, we walked over the ruins of Tantallon Castle, once the seat of the great earls of Douglas. The front walls, it was 4 square, are still standing, and by their vast height and huge thickness, give us a little idea of what it once was. Such is human greatness. Friday the 22nd, we took a view of the famous Roman camp, lying on a mountain 2 or 3 miles from the town. It is encompassed with 2 broad and deep ditches, and is not easy to approach on any side. Here lay General Leslie with his army, while Cromwell was starving below. He had no way to escape, but the enthusiastic fury of the Scots delivered him. When they marched into the valley to swallow him up, he mowed them down like grass. Saturday the 23rd, I went on to Alnwick and preached in the town hall. What a difference between an English and a Scotch congregation. These judge themselves rather than the preacher, and their aim is not only to know, but to love and obey. Through the Dales, Monday, June 1st. I began a little tour through the Dales. About 9 I preached at Kiphill, at one at Walsingham. Here we began to trace the revival of the work of God, and here began the horrid mountains we had to climb over. However, before six, we reached Barnard Castle. I preached at the end of the preaching house to a large congregation of established Christians. At 5 in the morning, the house was nearly full of persons ripe for the height and depth of the gospel. Tuesday the 2nd, we rode to New Oregon in Teesdale. The people were deeply attentive, but I think not deeply affected. From the top of the next enormous mountain, we had a view of Weardale. It is a lovely prospect. The green, gently rising meadows and fields on both sides of the little river, clear as crystal, were sprinkled over with innumerable little houses, 3 and 4 of which, if not 9 and 10, are sprung up since the Methodists came hither. Since that time, the beasts are turned into men, and the wilderness is a fruitful field. Thursday the 4th. At 5, I took my leave of this blessed people. I was a little surprised in looking attentively upon them to observe so beautiful faces as I never saw before in one congregation. Many of the children in particular, 12 or 14 of whom, chiefly boys, sat full in my view. But I allow much more might be owing to grace than nature, to the heaven within that shone outward. Field preaching as Wesley's cross. Friday, August 21st. I preached again about 8 and then rode back to Hartford. After dinner, we hastened to the passage, but the watermen were not in haste to fetch us over. So I sat down on a convenient stone and finished the little tract I had in hand. However, I got to Pembroke in time and preached in the town hall, where we had a solemn and comfortable opportunity. Sunday, September 6th, I preached on the quay at Kingswood and near King's Square. To this day, field preaching is a cross to me, but I know my commission and see no other way of preaching the gospel to every creature. Wednesday, October 14. A book was given to me to write on, The Works of Mr. Thompson, of whose poetical abilities I had always had a low opinion. But looking into one of his tragedies, Edward and Eleonora, I was agreeably surprised. The sentiments are just and noble, the diction strong, smooth, and elegant, and the plot conducted with the utmost art and wrought off in a most surprising manner. It is quite his masterpiece, and I really think might vie with any modern performance of the kind. Good or bad spirits? Saturday 31st, a young man of good sense and an unblameable character gave me a strange account of what, he said, had happened to himself and 3 other persons in the same house. As they all feared God, I thought the matter deserved a further examination. So in the afternoon I talked largely with them all. The sum of their account was this. Nearly 2 years ago, Martin S. and William J. saw in dream, 2 or 3 times repeated to each of them, a person who told them there was a large treasure hid in such a spot, 3 miles from Norwich, consisting of money and plate, buried in a chest between 6 and 8 feet deep. They did not much regard this till each of them, when they were brought awake, saw an elderly man and woman standing by their bedside, who told them the same thing, and bade them go and dig it up, between 8 and 12 at night. Soon after they went, but being afraid, took a 3rd man with them. They began digging at 8, and after they had dug 6 feet, saw the top of a coffer or chest. But presently it sank down into the earth, and there appeared over the place a large globe of bright fire, which after some time rose higher and higher, till it was quite out of sight. Not long after, the man and woman appeared again and said, "You spoiled all by bringing that man with you."